This is 91.5 FM MFO Medford. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily express those of station management, Tufts University administration, or the Board of Trustees. My show runs every Friday this summer from 6 to 8 p.m. Today on the program, a very special interview with the former global head of respiratory diseases for Pfizer, Dr. Mike Yeadon. He's from England, and this interview is with Majid Nawaz. Majid Nawaz is spelled M-A-A-J-I-D-N-A-W-A-Z. He hosts a show called Radical, and that is on the Odyssey.com web video channel. That's O-D-Y-S-E-E.com, and Majid Nawaz's show is called Radical. Here's a clip of Dr. Mike Yeadon, the former global head of respiratory diseases from Pfizer.
First, you've been lied to about the magnitude of the threat represented by this entity called SARS-CoV-2 and the disease COVID-19. Been lied to about that in every way, shape, and form. We've been lied to, and it's deliberate, and they knew it, and no action was needed whatsoever other than if you're sick, stay home. That's it. So they lied to us and made us very frightened of something that is not, there is no unusual new threat in your environment at all. Nothing unusual. The only things you should be frightened of are your government's reactions to this alleged threat and the vaccines themselves. So the second part of my claim is that all the measures they imposed upon us, made us take, like locking down, masking, things like that, every one of those is ineffective, absolutely ineffective. And again, I'll come to the detail. They knew that before they told us to do it. And I can explain why I'm sure they knew. And then finally, you heard, I'm sure, quite early on, the only way out of this nightmare is vaccinate the whole world. And, you know, here are these safe and effective vaccines. Well, one, it was never necessary to vaccinate the world, even if you had wanted to use them, and even if they were safe and effective, but they were neither effective nor safe. So I'm afraid everything is a lie, literally. Everything is a lie.
This conversation with Majid Nawaz and Dr. Mike Yeadon is approximately 1 hour and 35 minutes. If you're interested in more information like this, a special event is happening in New York City tomorrow night, June 25th, at the Beacon Theater. It's called the Minds.com Festival of Ideas. It starts at 7 p.m., and you can buy tickets for the live stream, internet video stream of the event, or to visit in person. Just go to Minds.com and look for the Festival of Ideas at the Beacon Theater on tomorrow, Saturday, June 25th. Some of the speakers include Tulsi Gabbard, Tim Pool, Dr. Cornel West, Zuby, and Majid Nawaz. Some of the panel titles include Media Manipulation, What's the Real Source of the Problem? And Satire and Disinformation, Where's the Line? Again, that's the Minds.com Festival of Ideas. Tomorrow, June 25th, at the Beacon Theater in New York City, you can get tickets for in-person attendance or for the live stream on the internet, which is less than $16, which also allows you to view it for 2 weeks at your own time. Now, the interview between Majid Nawaz and Dr. Mike Yeadon, the former global head of respiratory diseases from Pfizer. This is from Majid Nawaz's show Radical on the Odyssey.com video website. This conversation is approximately 1 hour, 35 minutes.
Welcome to another episode of Radical with me, Majid Nawaz. And today, we only have one guest for you, but it's a guest that was well worth the wait, and I'm sure you'll agree, well worth getting through with us together, and that is Mike Yeadon. Mike Yeadon was formerly Pfizer's head of respiratory diseases around the world, a former vice president at Pfizer, who now is perhaps one of the world's largest critics, not only of Pfizer, not only of large pharmaceutical companies, but also specifically of all of these vaccines that we've been told were 100% effective, and turns out maybe harming us more than they're doing good. In particular, when it comes to vaccines, but also generally the COVID mandates, those that encourage lockdowns, those that encourage, say, for example, mask compliance and mandatory testing, the entire narrative was deemed unquestionable. Skeptics who perhaps were saying something doesn't sound quite right here were ridiculed were rubbished, were sidelined. Some people lost their jobs. Some people were called conspiracy theorists. But whatever we learned through that period, it transpired that almost every single thing we were told was wrong. The data simply doesn't match what they were telling us. In fact, it says the opposite. And in hindsight and with time, you can all see that now, and this show, Radical, has been going through some of that with you over the previous weeks. But with Mike Eden, what we focused on was on those four areas in particular that I just mentioned. We started by discussing lockdowns. We also discussed masks, mandatory testing, and also vaccine efficacy. In all, each one of those four areas, what we were told was absolutely wrong. And we go through it with you and with Mike Eden, and we go through the data. But it wasn't just those four. I'd be so confident as he is to say to you that almost everything we were told about COVID was wrong. And then that leaves us with one big fat question as to why. Why and how is it that almost every single Western liberal democracy made the same mistake at the same time on the same issue around the world? Either they're all incompetent in the same way, on precisely the same mistake, looking at precisely the same data, all coincidentally at the same time. In other words, their incompetence managed to somehow manifest itself at the same moment, or somebody was giving them, deliberately feeding them with incorrect information and somehow managing to get their compliance in selling us this incomplete information and subjugating us to comply or follow their orders based upon this incomplete information. I know what sounds more plausible to me, but one thing is for sure, now that much of the data is out, almost every single thing we were told was incorrect. And that's the conclusion that Mike Eden has come to as well. Let's not forget who he was. He was Pfizer's head of respiratory illnesses around the world. This is why it became so important, now that in hindsight we can see that everything we were told is incorrect from the data, from the science. It's why it became so important to ridicule those who were skeptics back then, to sideline them, to fire them from their jobs so that you didn't listen to them. But that ridicule in itself points to the fact that it wasn't just a coincidence of errors around the world that led to every single Western liberal democracy making the same mistakes at the same time. Because if that was the case, then those that were skeptic at the time would have been discussed with, perhaps humored, perhaps laughed at, but also generally ignored, because the data would have been able to speak for itself. When you character assassinate somebody, when you rip out a person's tongue, then what it really tells you is that they're saying something you don't want people to hear. And that begs a deeper question. Why? And as I hope you discover with us in our conversation with Mike Eden, what sounds more realistic is that somebody knew this data was wrong and was telling these leaders around the world to continue going nevertheless. Why would that be? Why would it be that if you knew lockdowns were wrong, if you knew mass compliance wasn't making much of a difference, if you knew mass testing was flawed, and if you knew these vaccines weren't doing what you were telling us they were doing, why would you insist on carrying on? Because by the end of it, we knew these vaccines weren't stopping infection or transmission. Why would you insist on carrying on, for example, implementing your vaccine passports? Well, it only points to one logical conclusion, and that is that these people wanted the vaccine passport infrastructure there for ulterior motives. What could those motives be? Well, think about this. If the vaccine passport infrastructure was in place, if we all submitted to the mandates without question and allowed them to erect this infrastructure around us, even as COVID had ended, it became the perfect way to maintain control over society. And that's what I think it's really about, control. And control can only be possible if you've subjugated humanity through compliance via narratives. And again, that's what I think is going on here. But it didn't work out too well for them because they couldn't control the narrative and therefore couldn't control the flow of information. And as a result, couldn't quite control many of us, though they did manage to subjugate generally a lot of people. But if you think about it from the lens of control, that's what makes sense, that you drive forward knowing that the data doesn't support your case because your aim is to get this vaccine passport infrastructure in place for a different reason. And that's why I think we haven't heard the end of what's been going on over the last 2 years, but it becomes therefore even more important to understand why what's been going on over the last 2 years was wrong, so that whatever's coming next, whether it be monkeypox, whether it be the global pandemic treaty via the World Health Organization, whatever is coming next can only be challenged more effectively by exposing what came before it, and in the last 2 years I'm referencing here in particular. And so again, that's why it becomes so, so important for us to have these conversations. And who better than to speak to right now Pfizer's former head globally of respiratory illnesses, former vice president, and now one of the most prominent critics of what's been going on with COVID mandates over the last 2 years, Dr. Mike Yeadon. Dr. Mike Yeadon, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for speaking with me.
Now, I've got to say, I've really been looking forward to speaking to you about this topic, and that's because of who you are, your background on the topic, and the passion with which you with which you speak about this topic. And so it's a pleasure to finally get the chance to sit down with you, and let it not be the last of such an occasion. Hopefully we have an occasion to continue talking. But for this one, because it's our first conversation with you on this show, mm-hmm. what I'd like you to do, if you begin by introducing yourself and a title, but also then go into your background and what brings you to be addressing the topic of COVID-19 and its mandates today.
Sure, yes. So thank you. And the feeling's mutual. When I saw you interviewed with Joe Rogan, I thought you have, as it were, the nested other half. I will bring the science approach and know anything about sort of political campaigning and extremism and so on. Yours is the complementary half that I wouldn't have. So yes, so I'm Dr. Mike Yeadon. I am now perforce a retired former research and development person from the pharmaceutical industry. So I spent 32 years in biotech and big pharma. I'm a biologist by training. I have a joint honours degree, biochemistry and toxicology. So I understand sort of inside of cells and how cells and tissues talk to each other and how dangerous chemicals can affect and injure humans and others. Then I did a PhD, so that's a research-based practice, 3 years. I studied respiratory pharmacology, so the impacts of various drugs on mammalian respiration. So with that 7-year background training after school, I went to work in the pharmaceutical industry. I did 7 years at the Wellcome Research Labs that became part of GlaxoSmithKline when the dirty snowball that is my former industry started buying all the smaller companies and consolidating. And so when that happened, I left Wellcome and I went to Pfizer in the UK. And I stayed there for 17 years. And all of the time I'd been in the industry, I was working on trying to discover new pathways, new targets and pathways to intervene in chronic respiratory diseases. So anywhere in the airway, from the nose to the lung, and also, you know, skin eventually, and allergy. So it's
when you say intervene, do you mean intervene? Does that mean a medical intervention?
Yeah. So basically, right. Trying to find new medicines. So if I can find either a target or a pathway where a new chemical could intervene as a medicine in order to bring about symptomatic improvements or cure. A cure is very hard with chronic diseases. So I studied in particular asthma, allergic rhinitis, and chronic obstructive lung diseases. So those were the main trio.
And so you could help me with my hay fever, could you?
Well, I've certainly got some thoughts as to how you can use the medicines that exist to get greatest benefit and smallest numbers of side effects. In fact, that's always what you try to do. So I'm a drug discoverer. That's my I'm a tinkerer with the biology. And I often say to people, I tinker with biology and read and read and read. There's no limit to what you can learn. Same sort of approach as I've used to tinkering with old machinery. So I have a passion for old motorbikes. And the thing is, if you tinker long enough, you can get some kind of understanding as to what's going on in health, why it goes wrong in disease, what you can do to try and, you know, push it back towards the healthier state. And that's what good drugs do. And there are some very good drugs in the industry. So throughout that experience, I grew from being a lab-based scientist to someone supervising teams in the lab, eventually to being a section head, and eventually I ran the whole of Pfizer's research and early development activities worldwide. So at one point, there were three sites, US, UK, and France. I was responsible for 70 people directly and a couple of hundred, as they say, through the matrix, people in different skill areas than mine. And by the time I left Pfizer, because it closed in 2011, we had the largest portfolio, that is, of projects, some of which were in the laboratory, some were in the clinic, in the early clinic, so volunteers and then early patient studies. We had the largest portfolio at the Sandwich Labs in Kent. So it was a tremendous disappointment when they closed it. But I had been at that point, as I say, the chief scientific officer of allergy and respiratory. So that was one of the maybe 10 or so research divisions Pfizer had. So that was my level. I was the most senior person in research in my area, although there were several levels of management above me. That was my skill area.
To make sure I've understood this correctly, globally, in Pfizer, on the science, you were the senior most person in that company on respiratory medicine.
Yes, I was.
And the science and of the chemicals that could be used to treat respiratory illnesses. And COVID-19 clearly is a respiratory illness. So would it be a fair summary to say that you globally were Pfizer's top scientist in the world in the area that covers COVID-19?
Yes, it sounds like a big claim, but that's true. Yeah, there was certainly, you know, there'd be someone who was like head of worldwide discovery research, and that wasn't me. I was a therapy area head. Pfizer divided its work into therapy areas. So sexual health would be one, and the Viagra drug was discovered a few labs down from me. Anti-infectives, so antifungal, so Diflucan, actually was an in-licensed drug, but the team working on similar molecules, again, was on the other side of the building. Carjura, you know, look, there were five blockbuster drugs on the market that had all been invented and developed out of Sandwich Labs. So unfortunately, I didn't do quite so well, but I was certainly drinking the same water coolers as the people who had run those programs in the decade or 15 years prior to me. So I had a very, very good grounding by people who had run successful R&D programs that led to molecules that were used, you know, in millions of people and still are now as generic. So that teaches you a lot, mostly how to fail and how to spot failures and the risks of them early. So one other thing I should mention is that...
Before you do, Mike, in total, you were there for 17 years.
Yeah.
That's a long stretch at Pfizer. Yes. And how many years were you their top science officer, their chief science officer on the respiratory side?
Between 7 and 10 years. They kept changing the titles as they reorganized. But yeah, I was the top guy for between 7 and 10 years. There was really a shootout, shall we say, between the different research sites. At one point, Pfizer had something like 10 worldwide research sites. And we all knew that was too many and consolidation would be followed by shrinkage. And it did. And, you know, I did my best, put my best foot forward, represented the worldwide portfolio. And on every occasion until they closed the sites, they retained my team and our site. So I graduated. Initially, I was like one of three and I was one of two. And then I became responsible for all of the work, including in America.
And when they closed that site, did you stay with Pfizer or where did you move to?
When it closed, that was that. A small number of people did go to the US. But here's the thing. I was convinced that we were doing good work and they closed the site for strategic reasons. Overall, probably wasn't producing enough bang for the buck. It's a very big site. So at the peak, they had 7,000 staff. So if we were a couple of hundred, you could see there were a lot of other people doing other things. So I didn't take it personally. I thought there was still value in what we were doing. And the evidence for that was, you know, in the 6 months between knowing I was going and actually leaving, I pitched, that is, put propositions to everybody I possibly could, you know, supported by headquarters to see if we could get people who would acquire those programs and those staff. And 4 months after I left, the world's second largest generics company, Mylan, actually did acquire my former portfolio, the inhaler device and several programs, and I think several dozens of staff. They hired part of the site that Pfizer had sold to the new landlord. So they hired back a building and just moved the staff over at the end of the year. And I'm pleased to report, although I had nothing to do with it thereafter, that company did finally get what we were working on to the market. It's a multi-dose dry powder inhaler for treating asthma and COPD. So I was right. We were on the right tracks, but we were cut short. But that work and those people did go on, in fact, under new management, and did eventually get to the market.
You did some good.
Yeah, and then there were other things. There were other molecules not in that suite that was purchased. And I was very lucky. One other thing, Majid, that I did was, because I was the senior most person technically, scientifically, drug companies often buy biotech companies, smaller companies. If they've got one molecule, they'll often get bought. And so for 10 years, my job was to chair the in-licensing team for my area. So we were always running the radar on small companies in the world. And I reviewed, I reckon, about 100 biotechs in that 10 years. So I shook a lot of hands and spent a lot of time listening to other people's pitches, which, as you'll hear in a moment, made me I was able to do it myself. And we did 3 deals in that time. So we look at, you kiss a lot of frogs and find very few princes. But what that made me able to do, well, one thing is it made me known to the investment and biotech community. So no sooner had Pfizer announced the site closure, within a week I got 2 phone calls from people I'd met once previously when they were CEOing a small biotech, and they said, hey, you're closing. You know, are you available to do some consulting? So I thought, wow, you know, here's my new future. And so it turned out to be. So I was consulting with permission before I'd actually left. I was, you know, wheels up at going out to Boston. That's where a lot of the biotechs are in the US. And my first client had been previously CEO of a company we'd reviewed, not bought, but GSK had bought them. So this guy had success. So I had a lot of experience of knowing what investors need, you know, small investors, venture investors, and what a biotech has to do. With one molecule, you haven't got a whole portfolio to catch you if you slip. It's like that's your whole business. And so once I'd been consulting for a few months, and I was out to dinner one day, and a venture guy leaned over and said, you know, you've just come out of a big company. There must be loads of diamonds in the rough, you know, things they're not going to move forward with. And I said, oh, yeah, it's loads. And he said, well, why aren't you doing something about it? Anyway, I had a chat. The idea was planted that if I could raise a bit of capital, maybe I could get these molecules out. Went back to Pfizer, asked them if that would be possible. They said, in principle, yes, without promises. 15 months later, I raised $6 million in San Francisco from a guy that just liked the cut of my jib. He said, you led the teams that invented the molecules. You believed in them, or you wouldn't be 5,000 miles from home, going up and down the street here in the financial district. And I just felt you would make something happen. So he bought complete control for a small amount of money. But for us, it was a king's ransom. So we went back. We were able to negotiate acquisition of a small number of my former programs that they didn't want. We got them out. And we then thought again, in the context of a small company, how could we create value with those molecules? And after a little while, we came up with atopic dermatitis, or eczema, instead of asthma, because there were very few drugs to treat the disease. The trials were shorter. There was much greater interest in that area, including from Novartis, who eventually bought us. And we didn't have the massive baggage of trying to go head-to-head with Glaxo, Merck, AstraZeneca, who all had really good drugs in the respiratory space. So, you know, we used the same biology. It was the same molecule, but it was like, where is the common pathology of allergic reactions, inflammation, and immunology occurring in the skin instead of the nose and airways? And so anyway, so the rest is history. A couple of former colleagues and I set the company up. It was called Ziarco, Z-I-A-R-C-O. You can still find it. And 6 years later, we'd raised about $40 million in total in 2 rounds of financing, run a clinical trial, had really good results, and then there was a bit of a bidding war. I wasn't the skillful salesman. I'm far too open, really. I'm no good. But by that point, we'd had an executive chairman parachuted in by the second round of investors, and that person succeeded in getting an unbelievable price. In fact, I will just say one of the jokes in biotech is that if you're dealing with units of money, they don't talk in, you know, millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars. The unit of money, Majid, is an obscene amount of money. It's like it's either a lot or it's an obscene amount. So, and you know, I found it amusing. I don't like the field, and I'm not going to do it again. Even though they said, "Would you like to do it again? You've been successful. Here's some money. Go and do another thing." It's like, why would I do that? You know, it was like 80 hours a week for six years.
Wow.
During which time my health failed. By the way, So I was able to retire early.
But as a result of that, you're able to retire and stand on your own two feet.
Yeah, I'm not you know, massively rich by any means, but I considered myself amply compensated for doing something that was great fun. And you know, honestly, I'm really glad that Pfizer closed at that point, and I had this opportunity. And I just want to knock off. Well, you know, people might decide, well, he's got the credibility. Here's three things that people say about me. They've said I'm an embittered former employee, that I'm doing it for, that I'm making money, and I like the fame. So I'll just take those three things. I'm not embittered at all. Pfizer was very good to me. I was there 17 years. I did really well. When they fired me, they let me stay for a year, you know, just to make sure I could clear the sell as many programs and get other people jobs as possible. That was my motivation. So not in bit. And then 18 months later, I came back with this venture finance money and we did a deal. And then we were good partners from 2012 to 2017. And then I made money for them and me. I don't think there's any evidence whatsoever that I'm embittered. No. And you know what? I never mentioned them. I never made a statement outside of my professional need to do it as a biotech. You'd speak to the press in biotech press. But I never said anything to anyone. And if anyone asked, I'd have said they were a good lot. I, as far as I could tell, you know, they were the people I worked with seemed all right. So I'm not embittered.
COVID struck, you had not criticized Pfizer in public in this.
No, world. In fact, I feel embarrassed that I didn't even criticize my own industry. I mean, I knew that they did, the industry did bad things occasionally, and we were not happy when they got that massive $2.3 billion fine for mis-selling, essentially. You know, we would grumble. Research people didn't like it. It's a bit probably like people who worked in ordinary day-to-day banking, and then you see, you know, somebody in New York has like nearly broken the bank, and you get a fine, and they think, oh, you're a greedy banker. I'm not a fraudulent pharma R&D guy. I was delighted to be paid to do something I liked and was good at for a whole career. It's like Fred Didman being paid to blow up chimneys or something.
And the fame. The third allegation you mentioned was the fame.
So yes, I'm not embittered. Making money, that's a joke. Since speaking out, so at the end of my career then, I said that I ran my own biotech after leaving Pfizer. And in that 10 years before and then after the biotech, I consulted to about 30 different biotechs. It was great fun. You know, I meet my opposite number. They would know a lot about something, but they would know bugger all about loads of other areas that I would know a lot about, having been in a big company. So I would provide them with a few hours or a day a month or something, and I'd get a nice retainer. And at one point, I think I had five or six clients. It was great fun. So 30 companies later, after I'd sold my own company, I was on the advisory board of two well-financed biotechs and having a great time. But as you won't be surprised that by summer 2020, I'd had all the phone calls I was going to get, which is, Mike, we need to talk. Several board members, investors, and potential partners have said, this guy on your website, is that the same guy that the conspiracy theorist, you know, that guy? Mm. And so I became the story and no longer an asset. And I said, well, clearly I have to go, and no hard feelings. So I've been fired by companies that were happy to pay me a lot for a few hours a month, and I was very happy to get that. So I've lost several hundred thousand pounds in income without any question. And I don't care about that, but I won't have it that people say you're making money. So that's one thing, so income foregone. The other one is I don't make any money out of this sort of thing. I don't know how to do it. People say, oh, you should run a Substack article and get a subscriber model. So I'm too disorganized and too lazy to do it. So I've lost income and made none at all. And then finally, for fame, anyone who knows me knows that I'm quite talkative once I'm comfortable, but I'm actually a very shy person. And given a free choice, I would be with my family or tinkering in my workshop on my own. I like to spend a lot of time on my own. And this is doing this is the most deeply uncomfortable thing ever. You know, I hated the fact that I was good at pitching my biotech because I'd have to go and give talks endlessly in New York, London, Paris, San Francisco, Boston, and so on. But I had to do it because I was good at it. But I would use what's called an extroverted auxiliary. So I'm naturally an introvert. But if you use a lot of power and drive through this not particularly comfortable skill, then I could do the other thing. I could be the person on the stage. But it's exhausting. And if I don't have to do it, I don't do it. So
now, can I ask you, so that's your credibility, your professional background, and you've also rebutted some of the smears that have come your way for speaking out.
You're listening to Majid Nawaz talk to Pfizer's former global head of respiratory diseases, Dr. Mike Yadin. Majid's show, Radical, is on the internet video website odysee.com. The Minds Festival of Ideas is happening tomorrow, June 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the Beacon Theater in New York. You can buy tickets for the live internet live stream, which also allows you to see it for 2 weeks in the future at your own time, or to see it in person. That's the Minds.com Festival of Ideas. This conversation has about 1 hour remaining. Now back to the show.
And just quickly again, recap, touch on the academic qualifications one would have had to have to become the top science officer for Pfizer globally on the respiratory illness.
So a very good initial degree. So I had biochemistry and toxicology. In toxicology, I was taught by the people who invented the discipline, Professor Dennis Park and I can't remember the other guy. But so I learned at the knee of people who were converting, just things go wrong occasionally, into a formal discipline called mechanistic toxicology. So that was good.
Where was that, Mike? Which university?
That was at University of Surrey, the Robins Institute. There, Dennis Park and I can't remember the other guy. Professor Jim Bridges. Yeah, that's right. Okay. So these would be people who were busy working out in the 1970s what had gone wrong in Cerveza in India, where a dioxin plant had blown up and poisoned lots of people. It's like, how does that work? What does that mean for the toxicity of related compounds? And the answer is quite a lot. So, you know, it taught me to have a love of and interest in the shape of molecules and what that means in terms of their biological activities, both useful and harmful. And this plays into drug design and my insights into vaccines, which turned out to be very accurate long before we had any data. And that's the reason I had a proper training in mechanistic toxicity. Then after that, one would have to have an ability to know how to decide what the right research questions are. So it's no good just reading lots of papers if you don't know, well, what thoughts do I have flowing from that knowledge, and you integrate lots of bits of information. What are the key experiments that will allow you to determine, you know, is this pathway for producing inflammation in the airways, is that important to symptoms in people with this disease or not? How would you do that? And so a three-year research-based PhD where you're working every day with a lab coat, doing experiments that you've designed, working under a supervisor who will be a more experienced person with a PhD, maybe a professor, and publishing papers. So you give presentations, you write papers for the peer-reviewed literature. So that was the background. Pharmaceutical industry is not generally very interested in publishing, and people who go into it need to understand it's not academia. So those who would criticize me and say, I've checked this Yadin guy, he's hardly got any papers. It's like, I'm not an academic. I've published about 40 peer-reviewed papers, most of which would have been in the earlier part of my career, around my PhD and maybe for 10 years after that.
What was your thesis on for your PhD?
I think it was something like the impact of opiates on respiration. Mm. So basically opiate drugs, morphine, believe it or not, it acts on multiple different receptors. Lots of things work on receptors which precisely fit a protein on the surface of a cell. And it turns
Remind
out...
Remind me, if... If you can remind me, when we move and touch on midazolam, morphine was given with it. So remind me to touch on that when we get
exactly. to it. Exactly. So what I discovered is that we've known for a long time that you can get good pain relief with opiate drugs like morphine. But we've also known that if you take very high doses of that, yes, in fact, that's what was done in the hospitals. In COVID, I'm afraid, people were given midazolam, as you've mentioned, and also morphine to suppress pain, but it also suppresses respiration and cardiovascular function. And my PhD, the goal of my PhD was to work out, could you separate the mechanisms, the receptors that mediated pain relief from the receptors that produced depression of respiration? The answer, sadly, was no, in humans or in animals. It was the same set of receptors in the same parts of the brain, the brain stem, and so on. So, you know, it was a big no at the end, but I think it was a good piece of work, and it also closed off an avenue. There was no point in trying to make pain relievers that would have a safer profile, because it was not mechanistically possible, and there have not been any since. So that was what I did.
So this brings us right up into why we're speaking, because you've got this illustrious business career in Pfizer, which is actually, out of all of the pharmaceuticals, that's the one that I'm really interested in anyway.
So yes,
it really does point to your credibility for this conversation. On top of that, you've got the academic qualifications, but also I think actually you've got the t-shirt, because the smears that you've alluded to, that usually comes for somebody who I believe is above the target. And so the intensity of the campaign against you that I've also noticed, I think points me to the fact that we need to talk, and that's why we're here today. So I think that's
probably right. And I will say that the attacks nearly put me off. I mean, I don't like it. I don't bear it easily. And my coping strategy most of the time is simply not to look at any of it. I don't read anything that's clearly unpleasant. I don't try and rebut people's claimed rebuttal interviews, because I know that they failed. They're lying, because you know I've been considering the same small bits of science, shall we say, for about 2 years, and I got a PhD in 3 years, so I think I can fairly say, and I got up into speed in a new area entirely, dermatology, when I went into my biotech company. I got up to speed with that in like 18 months, to the point where the ultimate buyer complimented me. He said, you know, you've given good account of yourself presenting to the dermatology division of Novartis in Basel, Switzerland, and I see you don't have a training in it. So, you know, well done. That is, if you can speak to their experts, my opposite number, and not be found wanting, it meant we'd worked hard enough to understand enough about their area to speak competently. So in 2 years, folks, there is no difficulty when I describe the lies, that is, the misinformation you've been given. There's no doubt I'm not kind of roughly thinking it might be a bit wrong. It is wrong. I could spend an hour on each one.
Well, this brings us neatly to the headline claims. And what I'd like you to do is tell our audience what you're, as Pfizer's former top global chief science officer for the company in the world, dealing with respiratory illnesses.
Yeah.
What are the claims, the headline claims you're making about what we've learned about COVID?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'll do it in three things. First, you've been lied to about the magnitude of the threat represented by this entity called SARS-CoV-2 and the disease COVID-19. Been lied to about that in every way, shape, and form. And we can go to
you
the
mean
details.
It's not as threatening as we've been told?
Basically, I'll come back to it, but the bottom line is we've been lied to, and it's deliberate, and they knew it, and no action was needed whatsoever other than if you're sick, stay home. That's it. And so they lied to us and made us very frightened of something that is not, there is no unusual new threat in your environment at all. Nothing unusual. The only things you should be frightened of are your government's reactions to this alleged threat and the vaccines themselves. So the second part of my claim is that all the measures they imposed upon us, made us take, like locking down, masking, things like that, every one of those is ineffective, absolutely ineffective. And again, I'll come to the detail. They knew that before they told us to do it. And I can explain why I'm sure they knew. And then finally, you heard, I'm sure, quite early on, the only way out of this nightmare is vaccinate the whole world. And, you know, here are these safe and effective vaccines. Well, one, it was never necessary to vaccinate the world, even if you had wanted to use them and even if they were safe and effective, but they were neither effective nor safe. So I'm afraid everything is a lie, literally. Everything is a lie. And
so let me get this straight, because people are here, people may not realize what they just heard.
Yeah.
So let's make it very clear for everybody, the claims you made, and we're going to get to that evidence, but just for our audience, Pfizer's top science officer globally on respiratory illnesses is saying what we were told about the danger levels of COVID-19 is a lie.
Yeah.
It's not as dangerous as we were told, and we didn't need to do anything. All of the measures that government put forward to try and address it were wrong.
Yeah.
And in your view, counterproductive.
Yeah, they definitely didn't work, and they had consequences, some of them awful.
Negative. Yeah. And the vaccines, you're saying, don't work.
No.
They don't work.
If someone finds a little corner that says there's a slight benefit in someone over 85 or something, possibly, the main problem with them is there's no dose where you can get obvious signs of benefit without attendant harms that are much greater at a population level than any possible benefit. So, and in fact, they play together because the threat to the population from the virus is so normal, it's so similar to every day or every year seasonal flu. It's so similar to the best approach would have been to have done nothing at all, other than say there might be a new bug coming through. We're not certain yet. Might be a little bit worse than flu. Perhaps it was a little bit worse, but it wasn't like tenfold or 100-fold. There was no justification to do anything different than you would every year. I'm afraid we know this, that there are winter illnesses that we call, you know, virus mediated respiratory illnesses. I know there's controversy nowadays as to whether that's true, but there are definitely seasonal respiratory illnesses that tend to, I'm afraid they kill a small fraction of the oldest and sickest in our community. They've done it forever and that's what happens. That's what happened.
And so when parliamentary record, it's official that the infection fatality rate, the IFR, for COVID is similar to the flu at 0.96%. You're independently saying that that demonstrates that the virus was like the flu and in fact may well have been the seasonal influenza.
Yeah, exactly. So again, I know this dispute about whether this virus exists separately from other entities called viruses. What we can say is that people who are apparently infected, and the fraction of them that die is pretty much the same fraction, a small fraction, roughly 1 in 1,000, as for other seasonal winter viruses.
And now, Mike, does that explain for us why, when we were in the peak of COVID, flu deaths were flatlined at near zero? Because they were basically COVID deaths. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's very likely. I would just point out to people, here's something that's very important for you to know. It's really important. I'm not triumphant that everything I put out is a lie. It doesn't matter if 11 of them, I've written 12 and someone's written to me with another couple. It's not important to me that I'm right about all 12 or 10 of them or whatever. Here's the correct number, Majid and listeners. Here's the correct number of important statements public health officials and politicians should tell you about some threats and things you should do about it. And the answer is zero. There shouldn't be lies. So what's the correct number of lies that they should tell you?
Zero.
It'd be none. So I think there's 12 here. If it turns out I've over-egged the pudding and only 10 of the 12 are lies, it doesn't mean Eden's thesis has fallen to bits. It means 10 of them are lies.
That's 10
lies. The correct number
is
zero. They shouldn't be lying to you. They shouldn't be telling you that this is such a fearful thing. You need to not see your relatives, close your businesses, and whatever. Only go out for exercise once a day, all this stuff, all that rubbish that they told us. Oh, and anyone could represent a threat. You could all be carrying this virus, and so you might infect anyone else and kill them, save granny, all this sort of stuff. That the right number of lies is zero.
And you've identified 12. We're going to go through some of the key ones. So that we're aware, we can structure this properly because I want the audience to follow us step by step.
Yeah.
I'm going to park vaccines in a moment because that's, I think, because of who you are, the most important one. So I'm going to park that for a second because I'm going to spend a bit of time on that. But while we're on the topic of the fact that the virus that we were told was COVID may have been, in your theory, in your view, may have been influenza.
Could have been.
And the deaths that were flatlined, and this is not in dispute, that there were no flu deaths. And when people were saying that's because of lockdown, you're suggesting those flu deaths could have been the COVID deaths, but certainly COVID's IFR is similar to the flu in parliamentary record in Hansard at 0.96. Now, how do we then explain the deaths that, the excess deaths?
I don't know where their source was from, but I looked that number up yesterday, 0.096.
A little bit
less than 0.1. So if you think of 0.1%, for those who are not brilliant at maths, I'm not brilliant at maths. So 1% is 1 in 100. So 0.1% is 1 in 1,000. So the infection fatality ratio, the fraction of a representative set of the population, if infected by flu, that die, it's about 1 in 1,000. And that one tends to be 70, 80, 90 years old and usually has several other life-limiting diseases like cancer, hypertension, obesity, diabetes.
And so, Mike, when people throw these charts at us that state, look, excess deaths this year, and they, what's behind those excess deaths, or were those charts wrong? What is your view on that?
Well, we can't be the attribution of cause of death is very problematic.
Talk us through that.
Yeah, we'll go through that. But for the first time in history, we said if someone is positive in this test, this PCR test, then we'll say you have a disease, even if you've no symptoms. We've never done that before in history. Diagnosis always starts with symptoms. And then, okay, what's the explanation for it? We've never said, oh, you're ill, but you haven't got any symptoms. It's absurd, this idea.
You're saying is a myth.
Yes and no. It's just we've never classified it. And let's say I'm carrying one copy of rhinovirus today, one copy of the virus. I'm not ill. I'm not going to become ill. I can't infect anybody else. I've got too little. But what? I'm an asymptomatic rhinovirus sufferer. I've got asymptomatic common cold. You can see it's a problem. You know. So I don't know whether it's strictly incorrect. I would point out we've never done it that way. We've never classified people's respiratory illnesses in that way before. But there's a whole body of work now. Oh, you are an asymptomatic case. It means you're not ill. You don't have enough virus on board to render you ill. And that means you're not infectious. That's another one of them. What's one of the many lies? But in terms of deaths, though, you mentioned deaths. Yeah. If you're recording flu deaths, that will only be recorded and you'll see it appearing and disappearing over time in the death graphs. If someone attributes flu as the cause of death, so if they don't, then flu could disappear because people choose no longer to attribute the cause of death to influenza. And the same with COVID deaths. We have this absurd position, just to make it absurd, that if you were positive in this PCR test, so you said you have a COVID test, and say you were run down by a bus 2 weeks later, apparently that's COVID-19 death. That's a ridiculous one. But people do die. Roughly 2% of people admitted to hospital don't come out, because you don't generally go to hospital unless you're a bit ill or very ill. So roughly 2%. If you test everybody, you know, with a very bad test and you keep testing them with this very bad test, you'll get some positives. 2% of the people admitted will die. You can have COVID deaths forever if you want by testing everyone admitted badly enough and often enough. You can get, and then whatever, you can get, it will never go away. If you use this stupid attribution method, it will never go away. But it doesn't mean they've died of COVID.
My next question is going to be on the PCR tests themselves and the cycle thresholds. On the deaths itself, though, a death within 28 days was the official government definition of a COVID death. And you're stating that if you're hit by a bus within those 28 days, if you die from something entirely unrelated, but you've been tested positive by a PCR test, and you die within that 28 days, that's counted as a COVID death. In other words, a human being has attributed an arbitrary cause of death to
Absolutely.
You by a government guideline.
Yes, I would say, and in fact, had it not been for Professor Col Hennigan pointing out the absurdity of this rule, I think it was if you died at any point after a positive test, no matter if it was 6 months or a year, you were still counted as a COVID death. So I think in the first I think in the first wave, they included people who had died 3 months after a positive test. So you can see that once you had a test, that person, whenever they died, whether sooner or later, would always be a COVID
patient. Now let's person A is admitted to hospital as an elderly patient with comorbidities and vulnerabilities. Now, in hospital, they get tested. Say they hadn't had COVID yet. They get tested with this PCR test in hospital. Yeah. At some point post-admission, they get tested positive for COVID, and then they die within 28 days.
Yes.
That would be counted as a COVID death, even though they weren't admitted for COVID.
Yes. You wouldn't have to have any bad behavior on the part of, or any inappropriate medical treatment, which I'm afraid they did. But even if you had no inappropriate medical treatment, just by following what you said, and of course, no one's going to tell us the truth, but I remember working with Claire Craig 18 months ago, and I think we concluded they were being tested at least once a week. And it could be that they were tested more often than once a week. And there was one particularly ghoulish period where logically, Claire and I were working on this, and she concluded that the only way the numbers she was being given added up was they were also being tested after their death. Seriously.
Wow.
Bodies really? In the morgue. It sounded like in order to get the numbers they were getting, they must have been swabbing dead bodies, sometimes perhaps more than once. It's like, if we can get a positive result within 28 days after their death, we can call that COVID as well.
So now, the headlines at some point during this nightmare of the 2 years that you and I went through challenging, but at some point, the headlines began recognizing this. I do recall ITV began addressing some of this. Eventually, Ed Conway at Sky began addressing it. Yeah. But this question around deaths, now it's out in the press that something went wrong with the way in which they were counting deaths.
Yes.
But let's remind everybody that at the time, to even discuss this was heresy.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, I you're right. So if you mention any of this stuff on Twitter, you would probably get a suspension. But the key thing was we were lied to about the lethality. And let me tell you the audience two things. One is you may remember a falling man in Wuhan. It appeared on the news. The guy stumbling along and then going face down in the dust. And it was implied this guy died of COVID-19. And I remember myself seeing this, and I don't think I saw the absurdity in it because it was obviously an actor.
Well,
let me just explain. If someone gets flu, you start off, you wake up one day and you don't feel great, or you progressively notice you don't feel well during the day, and then overnight you have coughing and sneezing. The next day you feel awful, you'll stumble around, maybe have a couple of Lemsips and some paracetamol. So basically, you don't go from being upright and able to walk along to a point where a moment later you're unconscious and dead on your face. That's not how flu kills anybody. It's never killed anyone like that, not in 1918 and not in COVID-19. That was theatre to strike fear into the hearts of anyone who watched it. It's like, oh my God, there's this virus that's come out of China, maybe from an animal in the wet market, God knows what. And look, it's this guy's stumbling along and then he's just gone face down and died, a youngish person by the look of them. So that was one piece of theatre that they used. Then I remember they were chasing around the city. People were wearing, you know, full chemical, biological, nuclear hazard suits. And they were spraying something from their wands all on the sides of lorries, spraying the streets. We don't spray anything for viruses. We never have. We haven't during this one. That was theatre too, folks. For mosquitoes, you might do that, but not for flu. What were they spraying?
Yeah.
Water, probably. And then here's the other thing. There was a real-life accidental experiment called the Diamond Princess. The Diamond Princess was a large cruise liner with hundreds and hundreds of staff, generally younger than 60 and reasonably fit. They were working, engineering, entertainment, catering, and so on. And then most of the passengers, most of whom were older than 60, generally, you know, retirees enjoying a cruise. It turned out they became ill. Several people became ill. They started testing everyone using this very bad test, this PCR test. And it turned out after a while that we learned something important, which is that not everyone became infected, that not everyone became positive in this PCR test. Obviously, I don't know exactly the conditions of the test. But here's the thing. Some people did die. I think it was about 1% of the relatively elderly passenger manifest. And that sounds awful, 1%. But remember, when I've said that flu kills about 0.1%, one in a thousand, almost all of whom are old, 1% of an elderly population probably would have been, in fact, it could be calculated to be somewhere between one in a thousand and three in a thousand of the whole population that would include the younger people. Not one staff member on Diamond Princess died, not one. So, you know, it's exactly what you expect of a standard respiratory viral infection that overwhelms a small percentage of relatively elderly and sick people. And the reason it overwhelms them, and here's something that will completely blow your audience's mind away, here's that it's very important. The reason that they succumb and die is because their immune system is a bit tired and old. We call it immunosenescence. If the immune system has got old, it's senescent. It doesn't respond vigorously to this pathogen that, you know, you and I'm 62, you're probably 40 something. But, you know, it's unlikely either of us would die. You know, we're not fat, we're not old. And our immune system, unless we've got, you know, taking immunosuppressant drugs, say for cancer, we would handle it pretty well. You'd be really, really unlucky to die of any of the scores of so-called respiratory viruses. But this is the key thing. If you're 80 and already ill and you get flu or COVID, whatever it is, and die, it was because your immune system wasn't able to respond quickly enough to be able to destroy the infected cells before too many cells became infected and your system failed. And here's the thing. If that's true, and it is, why would anyone think a vaccine would help such a person? Because all a vaccine does is attempt to give an early exposure to a bit of the pathogen, the disease-causing organism, so that your immune system can wake up and get used to it.
And if your immune system's not working in the first place.
They don't work. Vaccines don't work in elderly people. The flu vaccine that they've been handing out for free for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years in Britain, I was absolutely shocked. I'd never bothered to look it up. But if anyone does, and I can find it, we can put it in the show notes, the Cochrane Foundation is, you know, worldwide foundation. It looks at all the, it tries to group together
C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E.
All the clinical studies.
C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E.
Cochrane, C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E, yes. It turns out that some researchers looked at the, I think it was the English or English and Wales experience of the flu vaccine after 10 years since they were rolled out, because they knew exactly which year it started and they knew what percentage of 60-year-olds and up went to their doctor and got it. And then they went back and they looked at what fraction of those 60 and up and younger people, what fraction of them were admitted to hospital for respiratory infections and what fraction ultimately went on to die with a cause of respiratory failure like flu, and made absolutely no difference. I mean, I'm depressed. Wow. I mean, I came from this industry. I didn't work in vaccinology, but I was depressed because I thought these things don't work. And I've worked out why they don't. It doesn't necessarily mean that the vaccines don't do anything. It says,
well, they would do if your immune system was working.
If your immune system's working, you will get a good boost. And it probably would make you less likely to suffer symptomatic flu. So instead of being off sick for a week, maybe you wouldn't even be very ill. But it's not life-saving. They don't reduce hospitalizations and they don't reduce deaths. They don't do it.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. You're listening to Majid Nawaz talk to Pfizer's former global head of respiratory diseases, Dr. Mike Yaden. Majid's show, Radical, is on the internet video website Odyssee.com. The Minds Festival of Ideas is happening tomorrow, June 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the Beacon Theater in New York. You can buy tickets for the live internet live stream, which also allows you to see it for 2 weeks in the future at your own time, or to see it in person. That's the Minds.com Festival of Ideas. Some of the speakers include Majid Nawaz, Tulsi Gabbard, Tim Pool, Zuby, and Dr. Cornel West. There is about 1 hour, 40 minutes remaining in this conversation. Now back to the show.
Right. Now I'm going to bring you to the COVID vaccine in a moment.
Same
just
problem.
Before we do, PCR tests,
yeah.
right? So we've spoken about death, we've spoken about the IFR, the 0.096.
Yeah.
Forgive me, I missed our zero earlier. And now on the PCR tests, the cycle threshold.
Yeah.
Speak to us a bit about that, because at one point the World Health Organization changed their guidelines. In fact, I remember exactly when it was. It was just after President Biden was elected as president-elect.
That's
before
right.
his inauguration,
yes.
or thereabouts, 5th of Jan, roughly. The World Health Organization changed their global guidelines as to how many cycle